used to their home to breakfast and for the share, and we'll learn the refuah shleima of Sarah Leah Bat Bracha. Every Brit has to have at least three major components. You have to have the, to remove the oil of the force which covers over the Atara, and then you have to do a priya, which is pulling back the thin skin that's between the orla and between the atara. With every baby that's born with an orla, most are, as almost all are, the orla has two levels of skin. There's a thick skin and a thin skin underneath it. The thick skin is the orla, and the thin skin underneath it usually adheres to the atara. And therefore, what Molim classically used to do, is they would cut the foreskin, the thick skin that hangs over the atara, and then they would have to probe to release the priya skin, the thin skin that adheres to the atara, and then once that stopped, once they got rid of the adhesions, then they would cut that as well and pull that back and then tuck that under the atara. Nowadays, most molim probe, certainly all the molim we have, probe before they do the bris. That way they clear the besar hapriya, they unattach the priya skin from the atara, and then pull both the orla skin and the priya skin forward at the same time and cut both at the same time. That's called the mila priya vatachas. That was a tumult in the postman at one point. Is that a good idea or not? But that's a common practice nowadays. When the baby starts crying before the bris, usually it's because the baby just doesn't like being bothered, or it's because they're unattaching the besar apriya from the atara. The mola who move very, very quickly is because they did that before. The mola will go very, very fast is because they do all of that before the baby comes into the shul. Was that? Whatever, they clear that, right? They clear it before. And that way, when the baby's presented during the bris, so then they can pull the star atri and the star together very smoothly. The molim who usually are slower is because they didn't do that, and for various reasons, either because that's their practice or because they feel to put the baby under an extra trauma to do it separately, so they do it all at the same time. But a mole, known as a slow mole, so to speak, that's because he's usually doing the probing right then before doing the bris and clearing the atar at that point. The third part is metzitza. As the Mishnah says in Shabbos, because I'm going out, osin kol tzechinilu b'Shabbos. We do all our sugyas of bris are in the Masechta Shabbos. They're in the context of the din of a milah shekiyum rosh b'mincha Shabbos. So the Mishnah says that whatever is required for bris is done in Shabbos, is Zocha Shabbos, that's the din. That v'yema shmini afilu b'Shabbos. So molin, we cut the besara orla, we pour it in, we pull back the thin skin that's below the besara orla, and between the atara, we cut that and pull that back as well. Umotzin, and then we suction, and we suck the blood of the mokum abris. V'nosin ala esplanet v'chamon, we put various disinfectants there. And then the Gemara goes on to this mission, goes on to discuss. So what happens if we didn't prepare the disinfectant before Shabbos? So we try to. So that's the Shabbos Acholish Shusakana. So therefore, we prepare the disinfectants with some kind of shemit. So the Gemara says in the second source, Shabbos Kuflam and Gilam at Beis. The Gemara says Motzin. We know that you have to cut the foreskin. We know that you have to pull back the Basar Apriya, but where does Motzin come from? So Amar Rav Papa, Gemara quotes another din, and this helps us explain the Mishnah. Rav Papa said, "Hai una de lei ma'ayit sakonei ve avrina lei." If a mole does not do mesitza, if a mole does not suck the blood from the mokum erva, sakona, that's endangering a child. The avrina lei, and we don't allow him to be a mole. We remove him. We make him hang up his ismol. And the shield and everything, he has to put everything away because he's endangering a child. So the Gemara says, Shita, this is a Dover Poshet Rav Papa said, if a moil is going to come and endanger a child, of course, he stops him from doing bris. Whatever Papa had to make it, had to give a whole shear, then a moil who's endangering a child is, so that's a Dover Poshet. The Gemara explains, why is it a Dover Poshet? Because it's a Dover Poshet. Because Mitzitza is Chilul Shabbos. Right? Drawing blood on Shabbos is Chilul Shabbos. Drawing blood on Shabbos is one of three malachas. The Gemara in Ksuba says that drawing blood on Shabbos is Nisa Deiraisa. It's one of three malachas. Either it's the malach of Dosh, of pulling something from its encasement. So drawing blood could either be a Dosh, or drawing blood could be the Easter of Netilas Neshama, Kadamu Nefesh, because removing blood is minimizing our ability to live. It takes away one of the sources of life of a person, or mitzaveya, it's going to cause some kind of bruise. So the Gemara Rishonim discussed exactly what is the malacha of drawing blood. But unless man the polling that the drawing blood is a chilul Shabbos, and it's a deraisa on Shabbos. Right, again, whenever we have to draw blood, it's always because we're afraid of a sakana sefas, a person in hospital, we're drawing blood to check for some kind of inner infection, some kind of value, so it'll almost always be deraisa Shabbos. The only time when drawing blood is discussed amongst the poskim is in the context of establishing an IV, because when you establish an IV in a vein, then you have to draw blood to make sure you're in the right place. So then also, if we're doing an IV, it's also because of Cholish Yishvah Sakon. So here the Gemara says, drawing blood is Nisa Deiraisa, and we are allowing a person to do the Mitzitza on Shabbos. That's what the Mishnah said. Mol and Uporin, that we do the Bris, and we have to do Bris and Shabbos, and we do Mitzitza as well. So the Gemara is saying, if we're doing Mitzitza on Shabbos, it must be, because without the Mitzitza, it's going to be a Sakana. So the Gemara says, so you right away see from this Gemara, that the Gemara is saying that Mitzitza is not really part of Bris Milah. Mitzitza is our response to Bris Milah. Mitzitza is something that we do in order to make sure the child shouldn't be in danger. Mitzitza really belongs in the category of making disinfectants. See, that's what the Gemara is saying. If the Mitzitza would be part of the Bris Milah, so the Gemara would say, Pshita, of course, if a Moel doesn't take away the foreskin, he's not going to let him be a Moel? If he doesn't do the Sarah Pri, he won't let him be a Moel? The Gemara doesn't say. The Gemara says, Pshita, that you would stop a Moel from being a Moel if he doesn't do Mitzitza. Why? So the Gemara goes through a three-step piece of logic. Number one, because we do it on Shabbos. Why are we doing it on Shabbos? Not because it's part of Bris, because it's Chilul Shabbos. And therefore, if we're allowing to make challah Shabbos, it must be because of the Mitzvah Shabbos. And therefore, if all doesn't do it, should hang up his mul. So the Gemara says, this is the Dover Pashut, and why did Rav Papa have to tell me that a Moyo who doesn't do Mitzvah be asking to stop doing this? So now the Tema, high down this the pocket. I might think that the blood that comes out of the Mitzvah area is pooled blood. It's not blood that's absorbed into the veins, the capillaries, and we're not exactly sure what the alternative. The Gemara Ksuba says that blood, the way Chazal envisioned blood, one of two ways. Either blood was nisqa tokit, it was pooled together, or dam, or the blood is taburi nisqa, or somehow conjoined to the body. So again, we don't know exactly how that fits into our thinking. The Gemara wants to know, in the case that we're all familiar with, is hymenal bleeding. The Gemara says, is hymenal bleeding capillary in blood that's in the veins that has to be drawn out, tiny capillaries in the hymen, or is hymenal bleeding that there's a pool of blood behind the hymen which is now released? What's the difference? If the blood is pooled and you're just opening an area, releasing it, there's no Chilul Shabbos, there's no Easter of Dosh, and probably there's no Easter of Tovei, because the blood's going to not, it won't get absorbed in some tissue, it's going to come out. Would it be a problem of Kedomo Nefesh that Tosh discussed in Ksuvas? Perhaps because the dam is already, the blood's already pulled outside of the system, maybe it's not considered to be removing it. So whatever it is, the Gemara is very clear that blood which is pulled together is not, removing it would not be a violation of Chilul Shabbos. So perhaps you would think that the dam mitzitza is blood that's pulled together. This is going to be an issue when we discuss taking blood from the cord, the umbilical cord in Shabbos. A Jewish obstetrician. Is he allowed to take umbilical cord blood on Shabbos? So one of the issues that's going to be discussed, well, is that blood on the cord, is it miskut pocket? Is it pulled together, just dripping out? So all you're doing is, instead of dripping it over here, you're putting it into a test tube, right? Is that everything? Or are going to have to squeeze it to get it out? So that's going to be a discussion to figure out exactly where the cord stem blood is miskut pocket chibui mikhra. Again, if it's not in Shabbos, it's not a shayla, and it's not a Jewish doctor, it's also not a shayla. Only shayla will be a Jewish doctor in Shabbos. And until we get better information from medicine whether how significant it is. So the Gemara says, what's the kasha over here? What's the chiddush of our papa? The chiddush of our papa is describing where the blood is of Damitzitza. That's what the chiddush was. I might have thought that the reason that we're doing Mitzitza and Shabbat is not because Mitzitza is a violation of Shabbat, which we are being matri because of the Kuach Nevezach Shabbat. I might have thought we're doing Mitzitza and Shabbat because the blood is already released. Once you make the incision, the blood is sitting there on top of the tissue. So all you're doing is taking blood that's already fully collected outside the tissue and removing it. That's why it's Mutter and Shabbos. Comes Rav Papa and gave a whole shear. What was his whole shear? His whole shear was that the blood of Metzitzah's Chaburi Nifbar is still conjoined to the body. It's not sitting there, it's not pulled together. And the Dumya Dislonis Uchmoy, and we should compare it to a violation of Shabbos, which could be preparing the disinfectants. So kilei of, it's like kind of just like if a moil will not close off, if he won't bandage the baby properly, and won't press the blood to a clot, and will not put on disinfectant, so we would say this moil can't be a moil. So apachanami, the Pope is telling us that we should understand. That was the whole shear. The Pope's shear was, I want you to know the blood of Mitzitza is blood which it would be in each day right to remove it. And therefore he followed through by saying, but we can do it in Shabbos. Must be because otherwise it leads to Kodesh Nefashos. And therefore our Papa finished up by saying, and any moil who will endanger the child, we remove him from the Ingen Bris. How far are you going to say?
The question was, you had compared Islamis with Chamon to Matita.
Yeah.
The only problem is the first Gemara seems to say that if you didn't do the Islamis with Chamon, you have to have the Shinui.
Right.
But do you see that for Matita? Perhaps not. So how do you necessarily categorize them the same?
Oh, that's only because there was a way to do Mitzvah Chamon like Deshinoi. I don't know if there was a way to do Mitzvah Deshinoi. Mitzvah was a procedure, sucking the blood out. If Mitzvah Chamon, there was a way to do it, right? And if and bottom line, if a person couldn't do it, so then he did it darkly.
Okay.
Shulchan Aruch passes in Mitzvah in source number 3. Anything which covers the Atorah, Ajitas Gala Atorah, until the Atorah becomes clear of any skin. And then you take a krum, a rach, a thin tissue that's in between the thick foreskin and the Atorah, you pull it back so that'll be below the Atorah, and you do Bishipar, and many Merlim cut it with their fingernail. Again, that's when they used to do it separately. Often you find a mole grows his thumbnail a little bit longer and sharpens it into a point. That's because he makes some tear in the Ora Priya. And umachzira lekan lekan, and you pull it back below the Atara, and Shayir, Bisara Atara, until the Bisara Atara. So that's why very often the mole will say, there's Gala Atara. Right? That's to announce everybody that He's done his job already. Right. We can go. So the acharkaf was then moitzin amila at sheyetsi adam me'amekoy mois harachoykin, and then we suck the area of the bismila until we get blood from the faraway places. Right? Well, that's the chiddush that came in time. The Gemara doesn't say this. The Rishonim add this phrase me'amekoy mois harachoykin, that it's not simply it's not a neshik, it's not a kiss, but you're really suctioning the blood. Exactly what me'amekoy mois harachoykin is. So medically, I don't know what that means. Can you from this area? Can you pull blood from anything far away? Dr. Levski told me that he thought it means just it's more than surface blood. You're actually bringing blood from below the surface, but it doesn't mean that your mom is getting blood from all over the body. They may look at things different. So it says the Mechaber Shulchan Aruch says, and he finishes up, Kedei Shelo Yavo Lidei Sakana, and that way the child will not be endangered. In Osdalad, we collected some of the ideas that come up in the latest form of Techemet that was written in the earlier part of the 20th century, and it's an encyclopedia of Halacha. So he has an entire kuntras on Mitzitza, not Mitzitza Befeh, and there he describes what were the medical benefits of doing Mitzitza, how does it work, that it saves the child from Sakana. So he says, well, it was a way of cleaning the wound. By bringing fresh blood from below the surface, that would prevent some kind of infection. It would also prevent the area from becoming swelled. Apparently they were something that happened. Baruch Hashem, I don't know if we ever see that, to see the breast becoming swelled up. Right? But today apparently something in the area of the bris being swelled up, which would be some kind of some local infection. So mitzitza was to clean the area, va'otzeziva zamet to help the clotting. That's how they viewed it. Right? And then there was another suggestion by another doctor called Meshazeh, who wrote a sefer Meshach Nefesh, that perhaps there are some curative powers of the spit. Right? Apparently there was a period of time when they would put spit on the burns. Even if a person has a mosquito with that.
Mama talks about that. On Shabbos, they used to chew up on wheat.
Right. And then
put it on a
burner.
The mission talks about if a Kohen has it on his thing, can he talk?
Right.
Can he take it off to do avodah and put it back on?
Yeah. So he's saying that then maybe that's the how the mitzvah works. And that lechora is the tashrus hadvarim. That's how we should view things. Now, but we'll skip Hages for a moment, and we'll go on to Yavav Zayin and Ches. There was three major challenges till modern times to Mitzitza Befet. The first one that I'm aware of was raised by the Tiferes Yisrael, perished on the Mishnah, Yisrael Lifkin. And he writes on the Perek of Bismillah, he says the doctors at his time are saying that it's really not necessary to do mitzvah. It's not going to, enhance the chance of the baby of doing well. The baby will do fine with mitzvah, without mitzvah. No. So so why is that an issue? Because it's an issue for Shabbos. Because mitzvah, then he said, they write it. Right? So the first of all was saying that he raised the question. Every time we do a bris and Shabbos, so that we cut the foreskin and cut the erpia, that's the part of the chomish. Right? We nowadays we don't grind disinfectants on Shabbos. Right? We wouldn't even do a machine. We have other ways of taking care of any possible infection. So we stop doing it. We don't do chomish lus b'chlal. Right, so the Tzvi Yisrael says the doctors are saying, you know, nowadays the way we understand it, mitzitza is not affecting the child's welfare at all. So what's that to do with Shabbos? That was the question he raised. So that it was an earth shaking question, and he himself, when he raised the question, he said that he thinks we should still do the mitzitza and Shabbos, and he's two svaras. Number one, he says that there is a discussion of our doctors who, what he was suggesting was Nishtanu Atzvam. He was saying they should change. We know that he lists, there are several things where Achrayim say things have changed in the time of the Gemara. For example, there's a discussion in the Bezana Gemara, if you left water open overnight, so you couldn't drink it because you're afraid of scorpions and snakes. It's a machlokes haposkim whether nowadays it's still an issue. The Gemara still says even nowadays one cannot have water that's left overnight. And the Rishonim would say that it's not that anything changed. All that changed is that we don't have scorpions and snakes around. So therefore we don't have to be miserable. And others say no, it could be the Nishtanu Atzvam that the snakes that used to be household snakes have venom, now our household snakes don't have venom. So or another example. Classic example is having fish and meat together. Right? So our general meaning is that the fish and meat together. But the Magen Avraham already raises the question. Fish and meat was an Easter of having some was a medical issue, not having fish and meat together. They're afraid of saras. So nowadays we don't see any increased incidence. We have many non Jews who are having fish and meat and much closer to than we ever dream of having it. And no one's there's no outbreak of Tziras or anything. So the Shtanu Atzvam. So we're not saying Chazal were wrong, we're saying that nature things have changed. And we find. We know that Teva has changed in certain ways. For example, we know that when a woman used to have a period, she used to have a Hargasha. The Gemara says that a woman would never be able to sleep through the onset of her period. But we know it doesn't happen nowadays. So we know that certain things of Teva have changed. So now the question is, the Tracy Ross, maybe it's one of those things, that nature has changed, and therefore a child nowadays is not being endangered by not being mitzitza. How can I do it in Shabbos? So then he argues that there are certain doctors in his time who said, there still is a value of the mitzitza, still would reduce swelling. And he says that there are certain countries where the child is more prone to than other countries. He says, once the machlokes amongst the doctors, so then we have to go with Chazal. Right? Once the doctor is saying that there could be some benefit to it, then we shouldn't, then we don't change them. And then, I don't know if the Rishon himself said this, but another one of the other Sforim says that you can't really prove that something is not of benefit. Right? And as you can't prove that children, now we have, in the first time, they already had many children who were not having matzitza, either because there were Jews who were doing bris without matzitza, or because non-Jews were doing circumcision. We certainly now have certainly a huge amount of data on non-Jewish kids getting circs, and there's no matzitza, right? They clot the blood, then we would clot the blood. They wouldn't do matzitza. So we have all of this literature that clearly would show, in all of these situations that show, without matzitza, the child does fine. So some sources say, you don't know. You don't know whether there is some infection that one in X number of children get down the road that would have been staved off and not from matzitza. You can never prove that not doing something does not cause some kind of sakana, especially if you don't have an immediate sakana down the road. So that is the basis for us building matzitza neyom hazeh.
Some far from possibility
that you would be
the
Shabbos.
If it's a Shabbos bread, because 1 in 10,000 kids
may get some kind of thing, may get some kind of infection that we are not. I'm not sure what the numbers would be. Not sure what numbers it would be. I don't know. But the first of all, the saying was, some of these farms say that he haven't made a case. And he can't prove it. It's not that we're saying that there could be some infections the kid gets down the road that, who knows, maybe, there's no way of proving it. Maybe there was, in the non-Jewish literature, when they advocated circumcision in general. In other words, until recently, the non-Jews were advocating circs. Why? Because they found there were two concerns. One is UTI. They found that the children who didn't have circumcisions had a greater chance of urinary tract infections. But that's not during when they were children. They're not when they were babies. That was even down the road. And there was a concern that it raised the level of cervical cancer in their mates later on. That's not circumcision. That's a little bit different. That's because there's more area there. They can get
bacteria.
Bacteria. Yeah. So this argument would be that we're talking about a neighbor from Shana, how long he could be going to live. Maybe there was some later on residual effect. They're not even matzitza. So that's where the numbers. We don't have access to those numbers. So once Chazal says that we can't disprove it, nope. So then we shouldn't do away with it. And I think, to my surprise, I think that the general track is do matzitza on Shabbos now. Even though to me the first world argument is a very powerful argument, but I think that's the limit. I think Dr. Leslie told me that when he asked Rav Moshe once, so Rav Moshe said, should do it, but don't suck so hard. So I'm not sure that it could be, what was the Rav Moshe's svara? It could be, just get the service blood. Exactly what he's saying. Don't be, again, it's hard to know. The on-the-spot comment.
Is it possible that the benefit of matzitza hasn't been reduced, but just that we have so many more options medically, from ointments and disinfectants and all the stuff, that those sort of have taken the place of matzitza?
Right.
You wouldn't use those and you do matzitza the way they used to do it, and
right.
Whatever ointments, they would still have it.
Right, so if you argue that, then we should really do away with it.
Right.
If you argue that, then we can certainly do away with it. Right. Now, in response to the first Yisrael, and in response to various medical concerns that began to be raised already in the 1800s, right? For example, we'll do two more of the challenges. One is in the time of Chassam Sofer. That's source number 7. This is known as the Chassam Sofer's letter to the Wiener Moil, the famous thing called the Wiener Moil. It was a Moil in Vienna. And he did not, he was concerned that doing matzitza was causing some kind of infection amongst some babies. He found a higher incidence of infection amongst some of his clients. So therefore he did not want to do matzitza anymore.
So he found a higher infection, higher
right.
Data.
Some of the babies that he had done. So you want to?
But he didn't have a group that he didn't tease in group. He didn't
do the
teasing.
No. He modeled how to have. Right. So the babies in the end.
We're going to double blast stuff.
Exactly.
One on Shabbos.
So yeah, so they found in the end certain children getting infections, and the Vinamo was afraid that he was the one who was involved in this. So he went to the Rav of Vienne and he said he really wants to, he would want to stop doing the pizza. That was his approach. So they wrote the Chassam Sofer. And the Chassam Sofer, there's a number of interesting things with the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer then advocated to use a sword, to use a gauze, and to press the gauze on top of the Mokum Orla, and you draw blood out that way. Now what's interesting with the Chassam Sofer, number one, is he didn't print this in his Sefer of Shuas. It's a letter that was printed in other places. I don't know why. Number two was the Chassam Sofer was always the one who was very concerned about any kind of change in Minhagim. And here he became the advocate of this change. Right? And and there were various questions that were raised. And you see from this, I have four points that he raises in his Shuva. Number one, Ein lanu esek bin asoris. We don't heicha the ikol and heicha shusakanta koldu. We don't worry about Kabbalah if it's a question of the slightest sakana. What was he referring to? So look at number one of the strongest counter arguments against any kind of change in Mitzitza is that Mitzitza in the Zohar is not viewed simply as something that's done for medical reasons. In the Zohar, the mitzitza is seen as one of the three steps of bris. The Rachaim quotes it in on the pasuk of Yimol Besar Olase. Says the Rachaim, based on the Zohar, there are three parts of bris. There's Yimol, that's getting rid of the foreskin. There's Besar, that's peeling back the Besar of Priya. And Olase, he says, refers to removing the blood. Why is that? He says because the Zohar says that the idea behind Bris Milah is separating, making distinctions, separating between the different klipos. It is all of us, Kabbalistic idea, that all of us have enclosures that keep positive influences from maintaining an impact upon us and separating ourselves from positive influences. So the Bris Milah is a mitzvah that gives us a direction that we're supposed to be removing klipos. We're supposed to be removing different shells that we have, shells that don't allow the neshama and the most positive influences to have an impact upon us. So the basar, so first we remove this outer skin which is just unattached. It's we would call it a gross klipa, the large shell, easily recognizable, that sometimes doesn't allow the neshama to express itself. And then there's a thinner skin, which is adhered, which is much more a part of us. And sometimes that's a harder thing to remove. But that also is part of our avodas Hashem. It's made of a thinner, adhering kind of shell that sometimes harder to divest itself. And then, he says, there are certain things, there are certain klipos that are really part and parcel of us, that have made their way all the way into us. And that's like the blood, the blood that we want to remove. So the Zohar sees that getting rid of the mitzitza, getting rid of this blood, is a part of Bris Milah. Philosophically, it's part of Bris Milah. And Rav Chaim says this fits in the process. So once you look at it that way, so then the Gemara, then we're doing mitzitza and Shabbos because it's part of Bris Milah. Then if you have a much bigger issue, can we really? if somebody would tell us, you know, there is an incidence of infection by doing a Bris Milah. So when we say that we're going to stop doing Bris Milah, we're going to stop doing a mitzvah d'oraisa, right? Especially if the incidences Judah's saying is unnoticeable, right? And especially it happened in the end, so for apparently for years and years it wasn't a problem, right? And the numbers of children do well with the Bris Milah. So would we ever consider not doing Kriya? It would have to be, you have to build a tremendously strong case.
This isn't a case of when you do a statistical significance. So if the first two boys are mild and die, then you don't do the third one.
Right.
But so there you have statistical significance of it. I don't know what the level is that you require, but so
right.
That's your question.
And he said he's correct. Right? Right, there you had right. You have to say, in the head of the rule of Chazaka, if God forbid in one family, two children die because of bris, they don't do a third bris. Right? So that is a huge statistical significance. That's two out of two. Right? So that would be the test before we would stop the mitzvah of the rice of bris milah.
Is that only two out of two? Even if it's two out of five,
that would
sound.
Yeah, the last two, right. The last two.
I mean,
I thought it was any two.
No?
If you have four kids, two die.
I think you're right.
Okay. I think you're right. So that would be establishing some kind of chazaka, right? So once you look at this in the views of the Zohar, then it's a whole different parsha, right? And that's what the Chassid is answering. He's saying, "Ein lanu esek minasaros, heicha the ikal and meichas v'kanta koldu." He says, "When there's a sakana involved, so then we don't consult Kabbalah." In other words, we do adopt certain ideas of Kabbalah in our practice. The many practices are based on Kabbalah, right? That's when they don't go against nigla. But it is the machlokas between nigla and nister. Right? One could even make a slightly more elaborate argument. We could argue that everything that's in the Zohar Torah Shabbat, right? But for some reason, the Ribbono Shel Olam decided that doesn't go into the Nigla part of Torah Shabbat, right? Somewhere along the line, the decision Chazal Ribbono Shel Olam that this would be in the category of Nesoros, category of Kapol. So then we deal with it differently. That's what the Chassam Sefer is saying. If the Ribbono Shel Olam would have, let's even say everything is 100% correct. Mitzitza is part of bris milah. So why is it the Gemara, the Nigla, presents it as in one way, and the Zohar presents it in a different way? So we can argue exactly for this reason. Because when there's a chashash sakana, so then when there's an issue of danger, so then Nigla gets a certain process in the way we deal with it. We have to go through a statistical review, understand it, are there options, where's it coming from? If it comes as via Kabbalah, so now we have Kabbalah versus Sakanta Koldu. So Chassam Sefer says, if it comes from Kabbalah, then Sakanta Koldu, the slightest possible kana, we release it. We're not obligated to do that. So that's what the Chassam Sefer's first argument was. Even if you'll tell me mitzitza with oral mitzitza, oral suctioning, is required part of Bismillah of the Kabbalah, Chassam Sefer says, accept it, but if it's a slight sakana, then we release it. Right. Number two, he says, if the non-Jew, if the doctors say that there's something which is like mitzitza, which will have a similar effect to mitzitza, like svog, we should adopt it. That is what he's saying. The Gemara, the nigla, the Gemara presented to us as being a sakon issue, as being a medical issue. So now he thinks so the medical doctors of our time should tell us what is as valuable as mitzitza. As he's saying, since the Gemara sees it as a therapeutic issue, so that means the Gemara is establishing for us the way that we should look at it. We should look at it as a therapy, and we should find something, we are obligated to find something, which, based on medical science, will have the same impact as mitzitza at that time. As if it gives us a concept. It doesn't just give us a process per se. So he says, the God should accomplish that. Number three, he says, it's not part of bris milah. Yes. The job is over when priya was done. Right? And this is in response to a very powerful argument. Go back to number A. A very powerful argument that was furthered by the Maram Shik, the Talmud of the Chassam Sefer. The Talmud of the Chassam Sefer went against his Rebbe in this issue. And we had a Moel in our shul last week. His name was Rami Cohen. He's got a sefer on Bismillah. And he's in the forefront of the advocates to maintain the teaching of the fast. So one of the things that he writes, he's a survivor, he writes, and I come from Freshburg. Freshburg is the town of the Chassam Sefer. He said in Freshburg they still didn't teach the fast. His argument was that this is one of the few times the Chassam Sofer apparently did not, he made an impact in the end, but in Freshburg they didn't change because of Chassam Sofer. So apparently, either he's saying the Chassam Sofer didn't really enact his own tshuva in his own hometown, or this is the one thing that wasn't accepted from the Chassam Sofer. Again, it's strange also that it's not part of the tshuva.
Or else he's saying, the Chassam Sofer was answering his tshuva to a specific person.
Right.
That person felt medically there was an issue.
Right.
So then he says, if you feel there's an issue, then you can go with it. But if there's another mole that says, I don't see any difference, then...
So he shouldn't change, right?
Well, that could
be true. Right. He said that, I've been doing this for 40 years.
Right.
He said, I never saw a problem.
Right.
So he was using the same logic. He just said that based on the Chassam Sofer said, he heard that there was a medical problem in Vienna.
Right.
If you have an issue, then don't do it. There's danger. Martin Schick said, based on the medical knowledge I have, based on my experience, me and my colleagues, we haven't seen a problem, so therefore it should be continued.
It should be, right. And that's very much with the amongst the Yekesh Poskim, the Binyan Sion, the Yaakov Yitzchak Eflinger, and then the assumption of Paul Hirsch, so they also argued very, very strongly against the Chassam Sofer. And their argument was that there could be other reasons besides Sakona. Now, the Gemara does not always tell us every reason of every single din. So this is an idea that the Gemara points out. Very often you'll find that the Mishnah mentions a Sakona, and they give one reason, and the Gemara will give another reason. So the Gemara says that the Chazal were not always responsible to give us every single reason of everything which they established. For example, the very beginning of Sukkot, the Gemara says you have to give Erev on a Wednesday. Why? So the one the Gemara discusses, the Mishnah mentions, you have to get married on a Wednesday because at that time the hegemon would violate a girl who was, he had certain days when he would violate the women, so he had to smite the hegemon. So the Gemara gives an entirely different reason as well, that we needed several days to prepare for the wedding. So you see right there, the clear Gemara, that the Mishnah doesn't record every single reason. The Gemara writes...
There's another reason also, that on Thursday, that
they
should be able to go to bed.
That's the reason that the Mishnah quotes, right? But leaves out the other reason. The only going right, that's the reason why the reason why once the reason of a din the Rabbanon falls by the wayside, the Takan does not fall by the wayside, because there could be other reasons. They didn't tell us every single reason. It's like Kodesh Baruch Hu sometimes hid the reasons for a Takana. Chazal also hid the reasons. So we don't know every single reason. So therefore, their arguing is that this could be part of Bris Mila. Right? Now, and that's what some sort of arguing. Now again, not to get involved in Hanei Ashley Ravravei, the Chassam Sofer is easier to work into the Gemara. Because the Gemara said, what's the Chiddush? That you have to tell me that Moel doesn't do Mitzitza, doesn't do Bris anymore, because otherwise we could not justify Dinan and Shabbos. So the Gemara didn't come back and say, look, there could be other reasons, there could be a fundamental part of Bris Mila. The Gemara said, Sakonim. So the Chassam said it's a much easier way of reading the Gemara. But that was a powerful reason. Adzikach of the Maram Sheikh, this is put in number 3, writes that this was something we've been doing ever since Har Sinai. So it could conceivably be Allah Lomesh Mi Sinai. Again, it's hard to get that into the Gemara. But that's, and the Rosh Hashanah Shofar Hirsch and the Binyan Sion all argue what you were saying before. Hirsch's Lashon is that we have in a few generations, we have much more experience and much more data on Bris Mila than all the non-Jewish doctors have in any one generation. We've been doing tens of thousands of Bris, right? So in any one generation, you had Molim, you see the aggregate number of Bris Mila probably covers 2 or 3 generations at any one time. So our numbers are much greater. So we don't see an incidence of infection or a life-threatening situation. So therefore our numbers should outweigh any numbers that are coming down the pipeline. But that's what the Chassam Sofer was arguing against this. He was saying, and you might say it's part of Bris Mila, not true. Bris Mila is Mila and Kriya, not Mitzitza. And now the Chassam Sofer, the 4th argument, he says, we're not doing Chamon Vismunas anymore. Whatever those disinfectants were not doing it anymore. We have our own disinfectants. We have our own way of clotting the blood. So just like we were willing to change the Chamon Mitzvah, let's change the Mitzvah. We'll do a little bit differently. So the Rav Shamshon Farish writes, he didn't like that argument of the Chassam Sofer, because the Gemara says, I don't know if you have it here, Chamon Uslusanus Ukiyoy Sebehen. So that was never a specific procedure. there was always some kind of disinfectant. And the Rav Sternbach, I put this number 4 of the O's 5 in one more interesting argument. He said, if there would be another way of doing the tisa, that's an interesting argument, the chat. He says the Gemara sees that suctioning the blood, oral suctioning the blood, is an isa deraisa. That must mean it's kenarko. I don't understand, it's a normal thing to do. Right? Because if it be a shinui, it would be isa derabbanan. Right? The Gemara doesn't say oral suctioning is and din derabbanan. The Gemara says, thank you very much, we've done it in 5 minutes. The Gemara doesn't say that oral suctioning is a is an isa deraisa, is done with a shinui. It must be normal. So Moshe Sternbach argues it can only to say that oral suctioning is normal. That's only the only way to do it. If there'd be another way to do it, then oral suctioning would be a shinur. It's not normal to suck up the blood. So if it would be acceptable to use a piece of gauze, so then oral suctioning would be unusual. So then it would be Issa D'Rabbanan. The fact that very clever that the Gemara sees that it's Chilul Shabbos must mean it's normal. It can only be normal, it's the only way to do it. So therefore, any other way is unacceptable. So those are the arguments of the Chassam Sofer and some of the counter arguments. And again, it's amazing, the Chassam Sofer is one of the most powerful influences over Halach after Shulchan Aruch. After the Chassam, again, and I think what you're saying is correct, the Chassam Sofer probably, since he wrote it a letter to the end, so he didn't, and apparently he did not even change the track of the treasurer, so apparently he didn't see it as advocating a change. However, he certainly clearly writes that when there's a slightest sakana, there's an alternative. He can do it with the gossip of God. About 100 years later, the next challenge came to Mitzitza Befet, and that was by the Reform movement. It's not clear. It's not clear to me from the Tshuvas whether. You thought you were not uncommon. that whether this was organized from the Reform movement, it came at the time of the Reformers, but it also seems to have come from people who are doing Bris Milah. So it seems to be broader than just Reform. And that was, we can't do Mitzvah anymore. And there were three things, there were three forces that came down hard in time of Shem Shul Hirsch. One is the Reform movement was said, we can't do this, it's dangerous. Number two, apparently there were Jews who were doing Bris Milah and thought that Mitzitza was dangerous. And number three, the authorities. I don't know who the authorities are, but apparently there were authorities in Germany who were saying you can't do Mitzitza anymore. So Shem Shul Paul Hirsch developed the glass tube, right? Where you put the glass tube, and he says exactly how he describes. There are several letters that several years ago they came out with the truth to Shem Shul Paul Hirsch, and they put all this together. They came out that he described how many centimeters it should be, and that it should be very close, it should almost adhere to the Melchim Ebris, and there should be a piece of gauze there on top, because he wanted adhesion, he wanted congruity from the oral suction to the actual Melchim Ebris. He says that way, it's doing the piece of effect, because you're applying the same thing, the same power, the same ability to suction the blood off, and he writes that this is the piece of effect. This is not a significant change. And then he writes that this is for those people who don't want to do Mitzitza B'Seh. He says, if you're going to do Mitzitza B'Seh, you don't need my glass tube. My glass tube is not for those who want to keep the old minute. He disagrees with the Chassam Sofer. He says that the danger does not seem to be significant, nothing they have to worry about, and Chazal said it was for our best interest, so we shouldn't assume that Chazal made a mistake. In principle, he says that I'd rather just go with the Mitzitza B'Seh. But if you're going to have a person who says, I don't want to do Bris Milah, I don't want to do Mitzitza at all, then use the glass tube. He sent this off to Mitzvah inspector, the Rav of Kovel, the Golah Ador at that time, and he got together the three major Rabbanim in Germany, the Rav of Fulm, the Rav of Hamburg, I think the fourth Rav, they all agreed, and we took on a specter, wrote back to Shem Shul Hirsch, that I agree, that I'm not your suggestion, and I believe that it satisfies the requirements of the tzitza. Now, respect to himself, in his own shuvas, again, is not happy with change, but he agreed. But that's the Yotzer Shoshana first. What's fascinating is the Chassam Sofer, who seems to be a stronger advocate of change, did not in practice advocate a change. In prejudice, didn't change. So Shoshana Paul Hirsch, who was saying, this is only a backup plan for those people who won't receive the Fed. But he really advocated a change, because in Germany, they stopped using, they used the glass tube. Right? All German brothers use the glass tube. So Rav Shamshon Hirsch, even though he was more tepid, he in fact affected a much more significant change than the Chassam Sofer. And we have recorded, the Moshe Shemach records that there was a tuberculosis, and one of the tuberculosis epidemics, the Rav Chaim Soloveitchik advocated using the glass tube because he was afraid that this would spread TB. And in response to this, there was a chayim that came out of Yerushalayim. Not to change, we don't use glass tubes, we do matisse b'fet. So that was how that argument became finally resolved. So again, we'll just summarize and then make three more points, is that the three major challenges to matisse b'fet, the Tiferes Yisrael, that should not be done in Shabbos, because it should be Chil Shabbos when there are other alternatives, and that has not made its way into common practice. People still do matisse b'fet. Perhaps Rav Moshe's suggestion of doing it in a light way resolves that issue, because it will only take care of pooled blood. The Chassam Sofer developed the idea of using a sponge, and Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch with a glass tube. Rav Shamshon Hirsch said that he's still doing the Tzitzit B'Seh. It's a very insignificant change. Chassam Sofer said it's a significant change. The argument really rests on whether Mitzitza, do we go with the Nigla, with the Gemara that says Mitzitza is there only for therapeutic reasons, and therefore it can be reevaluated at any time, or is Mitzitza part of the Bismillah maybe for Kabbalistic reasons? And then issue number two would be, is this a situation we don't change a minhag? In other words, do we have significant enough grounds, and significant enough, the modern question is, do we have significant enough incidents to change the minhag? And should we say that anybody who's doing a mitzvah is protected anyways? Right? Those are the ongoing issues right now are, do we have significant grounds to change the minhag? And should we say that the mitzvah itself provides protection? The response is that we would say that Dr. Kroll will discuss now that perhaps we've reached the point of significant incidents where one loses the protection of a mitzvah, because one's doing something which is maybe a pshia, maybe a form of negligence, and we have precedents for Gedol Yisrael changing the minhag, right? And then I thought one interesting idea that I was thinking the other day is, who should make the decision? Let's say the parents don't want to do take one position. They want to do the Tzitzit B'Seh, right? And the doctor is advocating against it, or the mole is against it. So who should make the decision? There is an interesting tshuva in the Lamed L'Hol. The Sovetri Hoffman says that, let's say a child needs surgery, and the parents are against doing the surgery, and the doctors say the surgery is going to be better for the child. So the Lamed L'Hol says the parents are not the Baal HaBasa, the child's health. It says if rogue doctors say that this surgery is better for the child, then I'll see then they call it the community. It has greater violence over, you have to make a decision for a person who cannot make their own decision. So we normally think parents make decisions. It's not doctors. Parents are not Baal HaBasim. So therefore you have to go. That was that particular case. So I was thinking that would be an interesting discussion in this situation as well. Who's the Baal HaBasim over the health of the child? So maybe the community, they're the Baal HaBasim over this decision making. Now you could argue in that the Moalim are the doctors of the Lamed L'Hol. Something I'm not sure. That should be thought about. Judah?
Chaim said there were specific instances of TB, or just generally because TB was out there and spreading fast, he just wanted to...
So the quote is a cryptic quote. So again, so the quote is that Rishur Mach writes that the Drisker Rav, here's the Drisker Rav, that when there was a, that's all he says, that when TV, when there was a TB epidemic, he advocated the glass tube, and he came to Rav Chaim, and Rav Chaim said, that's what you should do. Yerushalayim, there was a chayim against any kind of change. Exactly when I think it came out of the early part of the 20th century. Right?
The chayim was a response to Rav Chaim?
No. I think it was probably a response to Rav Chaim from Horace's glass tube.
Did Yerushalayim consider that the Germans wasn't a valid bris? In other words, when they say this, I don't think they have a bris, because this is the three, you said at the beginning these are the three critical elements,
right?
And the third element, so it has to get a dom bris at some point of life to be a Jew, or?
Right, so I don't think anybody, and nobody advocated that if the Matitza was not done, that anything had to be redone.
Yeah.
Right, even if you say Alti Kabbal, it's not a perfect bris. All right, the child will live without a bris of Alti Kabbal. Right. But I think nobody advocated doing anything over again. Okay, I want to thank Dr. Pearl, who's if you don't know, is a neonatologist and is a very prominent neonatologist in our neighborhood, and is often helped us out. And he, in fact, alerted me to this many years ago. And perhaps the present medicine right now perhaps could have been avoided if Rabbanu would be more proactive a few years ago. And that's what I think. For me, the most aggravating thing right now is that what's happening in New York City is that the authorities are doing what the Rabbanu and the community should have done. And if we would have responded with greater focus, then we would have maintained full authority over this. We didn't have to lose any grip on this.
Okay, this is the last minute kind of thing. I apologize for being late. I was on call last night and just had to find out and ran over here. So what I'd like to do is, one is give you an overview of herpes simplex infection and give you an idea of why it strikes fear in the heart of pediatricians and neonatologists and what how severe an infection this is. And then I did make some copies of an article that came out actually last year, almost exactly last year, from 2004 in Pediatrics, which is the official medical journal of the American Academy of Pediatrics. And the title of the article is Neonatal Genital Herpes Simplex Virus Type 1 Infection After Ritual Circumcision, Modern Medicine and Religious Tradition. And it's a case reports of 8 cases of herpes simplex type 1 infections, all of them from outside the United States, and most of them are from Israel and from Toronto's 6 children. And one of the co-authors here is Robert Tendler. And I think just a good review. It was very important to come out with this because it formally establishes a medical relationship between herpes infection and the teeth of a pet. Okay, rather than leaving it out there saying, that's an anecdote. Now, oh yeah, I heard that there might be some association. Okay, this way, if there's a question, somebody goes refers to the medical literature, and actually it's sort of the favorite and established, well-established in medical literature. Now it's in the newspapers, and we know now of at least 5 cases within the last 2 years, but come a year or two from now, those things get forgotten again, and when the next case pops up again, somebody comes around and says, oh yeah, I don't know if it's real, and we raise this question. So it's very important to get this out in publication form. There are about 15 copies there, so you can make more copies if you want. Let me just review for you a little bit about herpes simplex virus, okay? The estimated rate of neonatal infection of herpes simplex virus is about, depending on the literature you read, 1 in 2,000 or 1 in 5,000 deliveries per year. Most of those is broken down into herpes simplex virus type 1, herpes simplex virus type 2. Type 1 are the common, what we call, cold sores that people get that are caused by herpes simplex type 1. And herpes simplex type 2 are genital herpes, which both of those are recurrent episodes. You cannot eradicate it completely. It pops up every week, few weeks, every few months, whatever it is. And actually, one of the other things about it is that you can be asymptomatic at the time, and you start to shed the virus even before you have symptoms. Okay, obviously, in this case, is of crucial concern because a mole who hopefully has a herpetic lesion would know enough or feel, you know, enough conscience to say, I'm not going to do a brisk. But the problem is that there are times when you're actually shedding the virus even before the sore itself appears and is clinically visible or noticeable. So that raises a very deep concern about direct contact. Okay, there are three modes of transmission. One is in utero, one is a peripartum one, which is usually type 2 virus, and the other one is postnatal acquisition, that is, you get it after the birth, and the majority of those tend to be type 1 type. Most of this comes from direct contact, okay? But to show you how much we are concerned about that, if a mother comes in with known genital lesions and she ruptures her membrane, that is an indication for a cesarean section within 4 hours of rupturing membrane. And as we are so concerned not to have this baby deliver over these lesions, just this brief contact of delivering through the vaginal canal and coming in contact with these lesions, that is an indication for us, from a medical point of view, to expose the mother to the risk of cesarean section. It's a small risk, but it's a surgical procedure. It does have its own risk to it. But the risk of the baby getting affected is so much greater than exposing the mother to the risk of cesarean section. So that, you just get a sense for how the medical opinion views the risk of herpes infections. Now, in one of the collaborative studies that was done, herpes virus type 1 infection has increased to nearly 30% of all neonatal infections. So now you have type 1 being seen quite a bit in herpes infections. If you have disseminated herpes infection, a baby with disseminated herpes infection, if they're not treated or treated late, the mortality rate is about 50 to 80%. 50 to 80% will die. Of those that survive, almost 90% will have some neurologic impairment, because what's very common with disseminated herpes is encephalitis. And that is a true infection of the brain itself. Worse than meningitis, which is the covering of the brain, but true encephalitis, that is an infection of the brain itself. So it is truly a very devastating disease. It can be very subtle, so the index of suspicion for neonatologists and pediatricians has to be very high if we have a newborn who's sick and we don't really pinpoint what it is. Nowadays, we are more and more prone to start babies on acyclovir, which is an antiviral medication, until we're certain that it's not herpes infection, because it only works if you start very, very early. Let's see, population studies. Now, the other big issue that came up was population studies in two hospitals. What about personnel in the hospital? Okay, that's what tends to get blamed often when babies post-natal acquisition. That is, what percentage of people working in the nursery, nurses, aides, doctors, are actually shedding virus at any given time? So there actually were two good studies done with that. When they did one study just doing a survey, it said at least one in every 100 individuals documented a recurrent cold sore each week. So one out of every 100 people in the hospital had some kind of recurrent cold sore. And when they actually went and cultured them, it doubled the incidence. Okay, so people didn't even know they had it, okay, and that turned out to be one in every 50. So that in itself raises a big question and a big debate within nursery settings. That is, what if a nurse comes in and has a cold sore in her mouth? Can they work in the nursery, or do they have to be excused from nursery and can't work for a week, whatever it is? The present feeling, accepted feeling, is that if they wear a mask and good hand washing, then that's adequate and will not transmit it, because it is by direct contact, okay, which is the accepted mode. But now you can understand why Matisse Bepede, when you have direct contact on an open sore, an open fresh surgical wound, the risk for transmission is just tremendous. Now, it's hard to get a good denominator because we don't know how many babies actually had meticulous repair. So it's hard to say exactly what the rate of infection is when you're doing it because we have no basis for the denominator. But based on what we know about it, it's if you actually have true direct contact with an open sore and or a lesion that's shedding virus, the risk is just tremendous that it is going to transmit disease. And when we see herpes type 1 develop in a baby in the genital area, it's hard to argue the point that this is not from meticulous repair. You know, they've had meticulous repair. It really is quite hard to argue the question of whether this is truly from meticulous repair or not. I mean, it really begs the question. Now, there have been cases reported of fathers transmitting from kissing their babies, but those presented with either oral and the babies developed in the mouth, eyes, mouth kind of lesions. And there have been reported cases of nurses actually transmitting it and mothers transmitting it. Mothers will have breast lesions on their breasts. Our advice not to breastfeed, okay, because then again you have direct oral contact, okay.
If you get like a temperature on your mouth, you can get one.
Right. Not every canker sore is herpetic, okay. Most of the ones on the outside are more commonly herpetic than the ones on the inside, okay. But the answer to that is that, yeah, I would not be kissing my newborn baby if I know I had a sore in my mouth. Okay. Again, it's by direct contact. So if you could use, and if you put your hands to your mouth, obviously you can transmit that way. So if you use good hand washing and not direct contact, it's felt to be okay. But certainly direct contact represents a true risk.
How newborn is newborn? A week, a month. 3 months, 10 years.
The issue is not how they act or the criteria that we're talking about.
I'm talking about the groups.
in general, definition of a neonate is 28 days. But what we're talking about truly is the development of the immune system. Okay, and the issue here is that a newborn is somewhat immune compromised. Okay, so what for you and I is contained to an after sore, okay, for a baby becomes overwhelming disease, okay? So it's hard to define how long does it take for the immune system to progress. If the baby was somewhat premature and was born at 35 weeks and goes home at 36 weeks, then you've got an extra 4 weeks there that you're still immunocompromised, okay? So usually within a month or 2 months, we still feel these babies are immunocompromised, and medically we treat those babies somewhat different than a fever in a baby, is a specific category of fever in the first month of life. We're much more aggressive in working them up, treating them first, and make sure the cultures are negative, so we treat them a little bit differently because their immune system is not fully developed.
The study that you said that you did in the hospital was 1 out of 100, and it became actually 2 out of 100. Is that unique to a hospital setting, or is that, you know,
no, that was
in
that
society as well?
Right, right. It was typical of society, maybe even more. But the concern here was the baby is actually being exposed to hospital personnel.
Yeah.
Right. No. But no, I don't think that it's higher because you work in a hospital. I think that reflects the general population as well.
And do you think the moles who have this sort of disease, whatever you want to, the herpes simplex virus type 1, whatever,
mm-hmm.
they get it from the baby, or they're,
okay.
you know, right. it's like as well for the mole.
Okay, so that's another good point, okay, which I was going to mention at the end, because in this article, actually, in the next to last paragraph, they mention that further oral suction may not only endanger the child, but also may expose the mole to human immunodeficiency virus, that's AIDS, or hepatitis B from infected infants. The same consideration that led some stages once to establish the custom of Matisse for the sake of the infant could now be applied to persuade the mole to use instrument suction. Okay, and I will relate to you how that is. That's the issue of keeping up with changing viral appearances, changing germs, and keeping up with medicine, okay? The initial concerns were for TB. Nowadays, we don't worry about TB, but now we have a host of viral issues that are emerging. AIDS was not an issue during the time of the Chassam Sofer. Right? It wasn't an issue 30 years ago. Now it's a major issue. And I will tell you a personal history about that, and that is that when I was first training as a resident in the first few years that I graduated, the standard for suctioning a baby in a delivery room was to use what we call the Delhi trap. And what that is, a little plastic container had two plastic things coming out of it. One you put in your mouth to suck on, and the other one you put in the baby's mouth, and whatever mucus you suction came into the Delhi trap. Okay? So instead of hooking up suction to the wall, getting a hold of a canister, a whole suction, it was easy, just grab this, came in a sterilized packet, open it up, put it in your mouth, and you were able to do deep suction for the baby. Okay? And that was the standard that everybody used. Okay? Now, along came issues of hepatitis B transmission, okay? Mothers who were carriers, which seemed to be noticed, and then HIV came along. Well, in our practice, the hepatitis B vaccine came out about in mid-80s, okay? In our practice, we had a big discussion about whether we should be getting the hepatitis B vaccine. Now everybody gets it, okay? At first, it was for medical personnel only. And we bantered back and forth, and being purists, and our practice said, okay, what we'll do first is that we'll get titers on everybody and see if you have titers to hepatitis B. If you have titers already, then you don't need it, okay? So that's what we did, and sure enough, I sent in my blood and got back positive for hepatitis B. Now, I never had hepatitis B as far as I know, but I'm certain that what I got it from was using the Delhi trap, because when you start to think about that now, all the vapors and viruses that are coming out, yeah, the mucus collects in the trap, but you're sucking in all the vapors that come from on top of that, okay? So this is true Matisse de Pere, this is pure suction, and we were sucking all this mucus and all these bodily fluids that the baby was being born with. And certainly, I turned positive for hepatitis B. I was happy I only had a subclinical case, and I wasn't sick from it, but by the same token, you could have gotten AIDS from the same, different viruses, you could have gotten hepatitis C, you could have gotten a lot of other more serious type things from exactly the same thing. So Delhi traps, within 5 years after that, got banned from existence, okay? And nobody obviously was using it. Now all medicine has changed in that we use supposedly universal precautions, okay? So like you're supposed to wear gloves all the time, and we do all these things. And all these things were unheard of 20 years ago. I mean, people came in, washed their hands, and didn't think twice about it. But now it's something that we really have to think about. And I think the challenge here is for halacha and medicine, obviously, to keep up with each other and understand the risks that are happening. Interestingly enough, one of the things that came to my mind is what we're seeing now, we're witnessing now the emergence of this flu virus, of the avian flu virus, right? We're hearing a whole lot about this. And what, if you just think about what's going to happen when we shluk kaparis now with chickens, okay? I mean, potentially, if this does happen...
They knew that. That's why they had a ketchup.
Well, if this does happen, I could tell you that it's really going to be silly to take the risk, because who's getting affected now? Even the few that are infected now in China are all the chicken farmers that are ones that are exposed to chickens all the time. So potentially, it's obviously not in the same realm of bris, but potentially that's something that's going to come down the road and saying, is that a sakana that you're going to be exposed, and should people be taking that? Well, there's an alternative of using kesef for the same. So the challenge there is just for medicine and what the present risks are, because it's constantly changing. And when I see the newspaper, somebody says, well, this is what we've been doing for the last 200 years, and God wouldn't have sent this for us. I mean, that kills me. I mean, I can't deal with that. I mean, the principles of halacha are principles of halacha, but they have to use what's going on in medicine. And
your opinion on what picks up the pair? I'm not sure.
You're not sure?
Well, you're against the tube. Because the tube is the one, and how you got your.
No, that's here. Your bloodletting, okay, and it's not so much collecting all these fluids, mucus fluids, that the vapors are going to be a risk to the moa, okay.
So clearly I'm for the tube. If you have dementia prepared, you should do it with it with a tube. Okay, which is much greater risk for the infant, no question. As far as for the moil, okay, I think there is a bit of a risk, but it's not as great because one, you're cleaning off that specific area. Here we're sucking out mucus fluid that is harboring all the bacteria. Here you're doing an area that's been sterilized with betadine and alcohol, whatever, so it's much less risk that you're actually going to inhale something from the tube.
Dr. Pearl, with your permission, I'd like to make a few comments. First of all, I'm an outsider. My name is Dan Berman. I'm an adult infectious disease doctor. And I'm a good friend of Andy Neff's, and he invited me here. That's why I'm here. I'm not here to cause trouble, so please forgive me. Anyway, I've also been involved. However, I've also been involved in this case. I've been called upon by some of the parties for medical advice regarding this whole subject, and I've had a chance to look over some of the literature. So just to clarify a few points, first of all, I just want to clarify about canker sore. Just a canker sore is generally not a herpes virus. It's inside the mouth, and that's, we really don't know what caused it. That's not the same as a cold sore. People often confuse that. A cold sore, you see it on the lip or around the nose. That's a herpes virus. So that's a problem. But a canker sore, like an ulcer inside the gum, that's not herpes, so that doesn't present the same danger. So I just wanted to clarify that as a side point. Now, regarding about transmission of virus, you made a comment there's a tremendous risk of transmission with Matisse of a pet. Against what you said is that, first of all, herpes virus has been around for 2,000 years. It was described about the year 100. Herpes virus, herpes flavii out. So it's been around for 2,000 years. So we say that things change, like age is a new virus. The herpes virus is not a new virus, so it's been around for 2,000 years. And if, in fact, there's a great transmission through the teeth of a pet, I would think that someone along the way in the last 2,000 years would have noticed it. But yet, no one noticed, no one specifically mentioned about transmission of herpes virus until very recently, until this, actually there's one article around the year 2000 where one mohel had two cases, and then this case in pediatrics that had eight cases. The other thing is you mentioned about other viruses, HIV, hepatitis B. Well, despite what you mentioned, there's never been a case reported of any kind of hepatitis or HIV being transmitted either from mohel to baby or from baby to mohel. There hasn't been a single case. So despite the, what you say about, it should be transmitted, yet never in the history of the world has there been a document. Can I just finish the quick last minute? There's never been a documented case of any kind of, or suspected case of hepatitis or HIV transmission. Now, as far as the literature goes to say that, well, it's in the literature, therefore it's true. That's established the relationship. The literature is not Torah. And, there are many articles that we have in literature that have certain ideas and they're not right, and the later articles disprove them. So in this particular article in pediatrics, two important points about it. One is that it says here in the article, the eight cases were collected from personal communication and experience of the authors from 1997 to 2003. First of all, they looked for these eight cases over 6 years. And what that means of personal communication, I don't know exactly how they found these cases. I mean, if you did a study and you looked for every case of neonatal herpes, then you find, lo and behold, every case had Matisse of a pet, that's one thing. But if you do it in another way where you say to each other, do you remember a Haredi kid having herpes? Oh, yeah, I had one Haredi kid. Oh, yeah, did they have Matisse of a pet? So if it's going to be personal communication, I don't know if they were only looking for cases of neonatal herpes among Haredi kids. It's known that all of them had Matisse of a pet. Therefore, you've established a causal relationship with Matisse of a pet. So I don't know what this means, that there are eight cases in their personal communication of what they remember that they happen to have Matisse of a pet, because we don't know how many other cases of neonatal herpes there were at the same time that didn't have Matisse of a pet. First, another point is that in every study in the literature that documents transmission of virus, there's always DNA fingerprinting to transmit, to demonstrate the transmission of the virus. So, for example, when there was a dentist who was spread HIV in Florida several years ago, about 15 years ago, when the CDC investigated that, there was very careful DNA fingerprinting to establish the relationship between the dentist and the patient. When it was found that it was hepatitis C transmitted from a surgeon, again, there was very clear DNA fingerprinting. So in all the studies in hepatitis B transmission, every study, and also in the herpes study where Dr. Pearl mentioned about the father transmitting it, that it's known that people in the household can transmit it. In that case also, the article had DNA fingerprinting of the virus of the father and the baby establishing the transmission. In these cases of herpes, now, this hasn't been a single case where there's been DNA fingerprinting from the mohel to the baby. So as far as the absolute proof, it doesn't exist.
As far as
hospital, that's because the mole refused to be cultured.
Okay, I would say that, well, first of all, in the cases in Israel, there were 8 cases. It says that some of the mohels didn't cooperate, so exactly, that's true. Some of the mohels didn't cooperate. So, therefore, maybe had they done that, maybe they would have found it. So, all I'm saying is that there's certainly a kashash, there's certainly the possibility.
All the mohels who consented to be tested were seropositive.
Okay. As far as being seropositive goes,
right.
90% of the adult population is seropositive. So the fact that they were seropositive really doesn't mean very much. So they're like 90% of the adult population. That's all that means.
It means if they were seronegative and they had it, that would be very good conclusive proof that they got it from somewhere else.
No, I understand that. All I'm saying is that they were seropositive like 90% of the population. So it's certainly not a proof that they transmitted it. So what I'd like to say is that Kashash has been raised about it. And in the 3 cases of Rabbi Fisher, there's also been Kashash raised about it. Again, there's no DNA fingerprinted to prove it. Now, he didn't cooperate.
It's not because we don't have the source material.
What's that?
Because he refused to allow culture.
Yeah, that's true. Now, the reason he refused...
How can you say there's no source... How do you use that as a rationale for saying there's no DNA fingerprinting when you're saying the person refuses to rule it out?
Well, I'm saying there's no DNA fingerprint. That's all I said. As far as why, because he didn't cooperate. Why didn't he cooperate? That's another question. But the point is that there is no proof. That's all I'm saying. All I'm saying, there is no proof. And there is a shash. So is there a shot? Yes. Is there a way to establish a connection? Yes, there is. DNA fingerprinting exists as a technology to do it. It hasn't been done yet in any of these cases, and I think it should be done. Once it's done, then you can say there's a proof that there's a relationship. Until it's done, I would say that there's a chashash that there's a relationship, but there is no proof. Is it plausible that it's not caused by Matitza B'Peh? Well, the argument to say it's plausible it's not caused by Matitza B'Peh is that Matitza B'Peh has been done for 2,000 years, and herpes has been around for 2,000 years, and no one ever noticed it before. And it may be, and in this case, in this article, it's just 8 cases of anecdotal that they have these Haredi cases. I don't know what that means. And also, is it more, maybe it's more in these kinds of circles of Haredi because they live a lot of children in a small amount of space where kids are taking care of the babies also. So it's plausible that there's transmission in this way. Again, it's certainly plausible that it goes through Matitza B'Peh. But all I'm saying, there was no riot, and there is a riot that could be found if the proper testing were done.
And I just want to have you're incorrect about incidents because the Shamsher Boyer writes that as she yeladim radim boli deis takona bikos matitza. He says that many children.
I just talk about herpes.
Right. Now I'm saying, but that doesn't rule out herpes. He's saying that we do have a situation where he said many children are dying after this matitza.
I don't know what it was, but they had shooting for it, but they had mila. Again, they didn't have a control group, so the teeth are mealy.
Whether
they had some kind of infections related to inch, I don't know what they had.
Because there
was no specific reference to herpes.
Well, I was thinking maybe also that the case with Sam Sofer, that could have been that mole also, that maybe he was giving
over. One of the two staff
infection, no antibiotics, and I don't know what it was.
No, but I'm saying that we do have situations where there were...
I'm talking specifically about herpes. So I know what these infections were.
Yeah.
You said it was earlier than around 12,000 years.
Right.
Again, I'm not a doctor, this could be complete nonsense, but since there was such a high mortality rate back then anyway, since there might have been a case of herpes,
it could have been, or not.
No,
I don't know.
I don't know if you've had any symptoms.
I'm
just saying, it's not necessarily, it would.
Herpes was known as medical diagnosis. Right. No one specifically referred to herpes as a complication of it. So I don't know. Could it have been? Yeah. Okay. Or not. I don't know.
Okay. But still, I think the point is that when there's a chashash,
All I wanted to clarify, I don't want everyone to walk away to think that it's definitely a connection. I would say there's a chashash. And it's up to Rabbanim to decide what the chashash. Rabbanim say the chashash based on the Chassam Sofer is the chashash, then we shouldn't do it until the clarifier. What I'm saying is that people should walk away that there's definitely a relationship on the basis of chashash not to do it, but that I would hope, and I've been pushing and praying, that they would do the DNA testing, get everyone to cooperate, so you establish it, yes or no.
Wait, the chashash that isn't the chashash that you're mentioning. It's a chashash of whether it came from the moel, right? There's no chashash that these babies had herpes virus.
Right.
Right? So where did it come from?
Right.
okay?
Right.
All right, so now if I have a known person who has a history of herpetic lesions in their mouth.
No, not herpetic lesions, not. In the case where a fishery never had herpetic lesions in his mouth, in these cases, they were herpes antibody positive. That's all the study said about them. Didn't say they had recurrent lesions in their mouth. So all we know that like 90% of the population, the mole has antibody to herpes. So there are other people in the household who also have antibody herpes.
Was a mother, some of these patients, the mothers were seronegative.
Yeah, you didn't look at the father, look at the grandmother, right. Look at the brothers, look at the sisters, look at the nurse. There's a lot of people to look at who come into contact with the baby.
Right, but these lesions arose in the genital area.
Right. Well, first of
which
all,
is very unusual.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and if you have someone who's taking care of the baby, who has a herpes lesion, who changes the diaper, then it could be in that genital area.
Okay. You think that's a likely source?
No, I said that. All I said is that's not food. That's all I said.
Okay.
Now, some sure saying. I know
I've learned,
but
we
probably said we
don't
have a
combination of the
result.
We had not done this too fast. Years ago, somebody came in, very taken aback last week, and caught off guard that Rami Cohen did it. Yeah, I was taken off that. Usually, I speak them all before, and he even uses the two. So I, you know, without coming out, I think we should have a rule, no to do with that, and I think that's the community's obligation.
And also,
the
law, why
don't
they stop
them from doing that? One of the shoes has that if the family insists on the affair, let the father do it. Why should the mole do it? Anybody can do it. Let the father do it. Which is an interesting approach.
So,
Rami Cohn was a cousin. The reason why he's here is because he's a cousin of the baby. This morning, the mole is also a cousin of the baby. I thought he shouldn't do it, even though he's a cousin of the baby, because it's not fair to the baby. He's only being cousins. One could make an argument that if it's mishpacha, why is that fair? That it could be that you just limited the. If a mole only does it to a on family, it will only do it, so then you can argue that they probably haven't picked up the.
That there was herpes. I mean, it must be. He's done a lot of them, I assume.
He's done about 300 a year for 25 years up until now, and he had, you know, there's no reported cases, and then he had the two incidents, one with twins, and the other one 14 months before that, and none since then.
There's also a subclinical herpes.
Okay.
And as you get older, your incidence of recurrent herpes increases.
Actually, with herpes 1, if you're herpes 1, the incidence of viral shedding actually decreases from the initial infection. So looking at children, they have a higher rate of shedding. As they go into adulthood, age 50, the incidence of shedding decreases. There are no clear studies about what happens to the incidence of asymptomatic viral shedding in adulthood people. There's no data on that.
But how often do they get recurrent episodes of herpes?
No, Fisher never. He never had asymptomatic episodes. He's completely asymptomatic.
But in the pre-viral Fisher, in the adult population,
yeah,
my understanding is that the recurrence rate of herpes is quite
similar,
right?
It's not the same herpes and herpes. They're not saying it's a high rate of oral sores. We see that people, like we see in the ICUs, that people tend to get herpes 1 when they're really immunocompromised and they're, you know, they're weakened and all that. But we don't see a higher incidence of recurring herpes lesions.
I want to thank Dr. Tan for coming. It's nice of you to warn me, so I could warn Dr. Carlotta.